Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome to today's reading of USA Today. The date is Tuesday, April the 23rd. Their front page cover story is titled, Donald Trump Trial, Live Updates, Latest from Gag Order Arguments, David Pecker Testimony, by Aisha Bagchi from New York. The sixth day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial is scheduled to start with arguments over whether the former president should be held in contempt for allegedly violating a gag order. Prosecutors say Trump has violated that order at least 10 times, and the judge should not only fine the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, but also warn him he could get jail time if things don't change. Even Monday, Trump again attacked potential witness Michael Cohen outside the courtroom, saying Cohen got caught lying, pure lying in a previous trial. Former media executive David Pecker is also expected to retake the witness stand. Pecker was part of a catch-and-kill conspiracy with Trump to quash stories that could hurt Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, according to prosecutors. Is the Trump trial televised? No, New York typically does not allow for audio or visual coverage in the courtroom. However, official transcripts of each day's proceedings will be published on the New York State Unified Court Systems Press website by the end of the following business day, officials announced on Monday. At close on April 22nd, Trump Media and Technology Group Corporation share price fell to $35.50, up slightly from open, but down 2.42% from the previous close. Prosecutor Christopher Conroy told Judge Juan Merchan last week that Trump has violated the judge's gag order at least 10 times, including by posting, "Has disgraced attorney and felon Michael Cohen been prosecuted for lying?" The gag order forbids Trump from publicly commenting on jurors, as well as on potential witnesses' participation in the case. Trump lawyer Emil Bove said Thursday that Cohen has been attacking Trump, and the gag order doesn't forbid Trump from responding to political attacks. After just the first three alleged violations, Conroy asked Merchan to fine Trump $1,000 per violation, the maximum fine allowed, and to warn him that future violations can be punished with additional sanctions, including imprisonment. Conroy later updated Merchan that the prosecution documented another seven statements it believes were also violations. Columbia cancels in-person classes. Protesters arrested at Yale and NYU, by Christopher Kahn, Claire Mulroy, Jorge Ortiz, and Mina Arshad from New York, as tensions over the Israel-Hamas war continue to boil on campuses across the country. Columbia University on Monday moved classes online, while dozens of students were arrested in protests at Yale and New York University, and school officials closed Harvard Yard to the public. Demonstrations at Yale and Harvard were planned in part out of solidarity with protesters at Columbia, who set up an encampment last week that led to the arrest of more than 100 students. The protests have raised concerns for the safety of Jewish students and fueled a national debate over student demonstrations as campuses grapple with growing unrest over the war in Gaza. At New York University, officers moved on the NYU crowd shortly after nightfall, as hundreds of demonstrators for hours had defied university warnings that they faced consequences if they failed to vacate a plaza where they had established a Gaza Solidarity encampment. Video on social media showed police taking down tents in the protesters' NYU encampment. Demonstrators tussled with officers and chanted, "We will not stop. We will not rest. Disclose. Divest." A New York police spokesperson said arrests were made after NYU asked police to enforce trespassing violations, but the total number of arrests and citations are still unknown. Columbia President Manoush Safiq said in a statement Monday that while online classes are being held, a working group of deans, university administrators, and faculty members will try to bring this crisis to a resolution by, among other actions, speaking with student protesters. Most classes at Columbia will be hybrid for the rest of the spring semester, the university announced on Monday, as students grapple with tensions over the war. All courses on the college's Morningside main campus will be hybrid, the college said, except for art and practice-based programs. The Medical Center and Manhattanville will also remain in person. Safety is our highest priority as we strive to support our students' learning and all the required academic operations, the provost's office said in a statement. Columbia is the latest U.S. school to be rocked by the Israel-Hamas war, which began with Hamas's brutal border attacks on Israeli communities on October 7. Israel's subsequent bombardment of Gaza has led to a dire humanitarian crisis there and fueled protests nationwide demanding a ceasefire. As demonstrations have proliferated across college campuses, students have also been demanding that universities show more transparency in their investments and divest from enterprises with links to Israel's war effort. Demonstrators on both sides of the dispute met student protesters outside Columbia's gates Monday morning, banging drums, carrying signs and flags, and chanting. About a dozen pro-Palestinian protesters shouted, "Resistance is justified when people face genocide. Resistance is justified when people are colonized." After a few minutes, officers with the New York Police Department told the group not to bang the drum. A USA Today reporter saw police handcuff two pro-Palestinian protesters and walk them toward the NYPD vehicles. The NYPD told USA Today that as of early afternoon, it had no record of arrests or people being taken into custody outside the school. The department said the most recent arrest was Saturday. How Columbia University became the epicenter of this disagreement over the Israel-Hamas war. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft, a prominent Columbia alumnus and donor, said Monday he has lost faith in the institution and no longer recognizes it. In a social media post from his foundation to combat anti-Semitism, Kraft called for the university to stop the protests that have roiled the campus and led to some tense confrontations between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and Jewish students. "I am deeply saddened at the virulent hate that continues to grow on campus and throughout our country," said Kraft, who is Jewish. "I am no longer confident that Columbia can protect its students and staff, and I am not comfortable supporting the university until corrective action is taken." The billionaire businessman referred to Columbia, from where he graduated in 1963, as the school I love so much. He has demonstrated that with millions of dollars in donations, some of which help fund the Kraft Center for Jewish Student Life at the school. Kraft closed his statement saying he hopes the center will serve as a source of security and safety for all Jewish students and faculty on campus who want to gather peacefully to practice their religion, to be together, and to be welcome. Shai Davidai, an assistant professor of business at Columbia, spoke out against the school from its front gates after he said he was denied entry onto campus Monday morning. "They have deactivated my card. They are not letting me, a Jewish professor at Columbia, they are not letting me on campus," he said. Davidai told a crowd gathered outside that he was not given prior notice that his entry card would be deactivated, and that later the university told him he would be allowed on the business campus to teach on Tuesday. On the social media platform X, Davidai wrote, "Earlier today, at Columbia University, refused to let me onto campus. Why? Because they cannot protect my safety as a Jewish professor." This is 1938. At a news conference, Michael Gerber, deputy commissioner of legal matters for the NYPD, said the city had nothing to do with the decision to deny Davidai entry onto campus. They're doing their own analysis, making their own decisions, making their own safety determinations, he said. That's not us. The university did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Dozens of students were arrested at Yale University on Monday as police cleared an encampment set up by students in protest of the war in Gaza. A statement from the university said at least 47 students had been arrested as of 9:50 a.m. Eastern Time. The latest police action against students protesting the war came as the Yale encampment set up last week grew to include several hundred people, calling on the university to drop investments to military weapons manufacturers. Negotiations between the protesters and university officials ended unsuccessfully late Sunday night, the university said. Early Monday morning, campus police asked the protesters to leave Beinecke Plaza, the university's main lawn, remove their belongings, and show their IDs. When some refused, the arrests began. The university made the decision to arrest those individuals who would not leave the plaza with the safety and security of the entire Yale community in mind and to allow access to the university's facilities by all members of our community. After the encampment was cleared, hundreds of protesters blocked nearby streets and were heard chanting, "We will free Palestine within our lifetime," according to the Yale Daily News. Harvard has closed its main lawn to the public in anticipation of pro-Palestinian protests following the recent uproar at Columbia. A recent announcement posted on the entrance gates said disciplinary actions would be taken against Harvard students who bring into the area unauthorized structures such as tents or tables, according to the Harvard Crimson. "The closure was decided out of an abundance of caution and with the safety of our community as a priority," according to an email received by students. The student newspaper also reported that the school's Palestine Solidarity Committee has been suspended. On Friday, over 200 students and others took to Harvard Yard in solidarity with the protesters at Columbia and demanded that the Ivy League school also divest from Israel-related investments, the student newspaper reported. Students at other Boston area colleges like MIT, Tufts, and Emerson have begun their own solidarity encampments, and the movement has also expanded to other prominent universities like Cal Berkeley and Michigan. Several hundred students gathered around noon Monday in front of the Sproul Hall Administration Building on the University of California campus at Berkeley. They set up about a dozen tents and said they plan to stay on site until the university system divests its financial holdings from corporations that enable profit from Israeli apartheid, occupation, and genocide in accordance with the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, said Benan Abdelalaram, a leader with the group UC Berkeley Graduate Students for Justice in Palestine. She and others called for an immediate end to the violence in Gaza and to permanently sever ties with Israeli universities, including the Berkeley Summer Global Internship Program in Israel. Students want to enact policies to protect the safety and academic freedoms of Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and other students and faculty who have faced blacklisting, harassment, threats, and the unwanted publication of private information. Abdelalaram said, "We will be here all day and all night." UC Berkeley spokesperson Dan Mogiloff said there are no plans to change the university's investment policies and practices. Last week, more than 100 student protesters were arrested and suspended after Shafiq called in the NYPD to clear an encampment on the campus's South Lawn. The Gaza Solidarity Encampment was set up by Columbia University Apartheid Divest, a coalition of student organizations, calling for the school to divest all economic and academic stakes in Israel. Administrators closed campus to those without campus IDs. Though protests continued both on the main lawn and outside the campus gates through the weekend, several more people were arrested, multiple outlets reported. On Sunday, the school announced new safety measures, including doubling the number of security personnel and improved identification checks at campus entry points. Both tensions continued to boil. Rabbi Eli Buchler, the director of the Orthodox Union Jewish Learning Initiative on campus at Columbia and the all-women's Barnard, told students to return home as soon as possible, saying the protests have endangered their safety. In her decision to order classes to be moved online, Shafiq cited intimidating and harassing behavior on our campus and the use of anti-Semitic language. Videos of the protests have shown tense standoffs between people holding Israeli flags and pro-Palestinian protesters. No place to go. Supreme Court debates cities' leeway to crack down on homeless encampments, by Maureen Gropp from Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday wrestled with how far cities can go in cracking down on homeless encampments as it heard arguments in the case of an Oregon tourist town that banned sleeping in public with a blanket. Homeless residents of Grants Pass, Oregon, faced fines of $250 and jail time for breaking the city's strict anti-camping laws until a federal appeals court said that the ordinances violate the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Now the city says its parks will be overrun by unsanitary homeless encampments unless the justices reverse the appeals court decision. Lawyers for homeless residents of Grants Pass said police have plenty of leeway to enforce disruptive behavior without turning people into criminals when they have nowhere to stay. Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping? Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked. Several justices seem to lean toward giving local governments discretion and limiting the federal court's involvement in local decisions, while also showing sensitivity to the no-win plight of homeless residents. Sleeping is a biological necessity. It's sort of like breathing, said Justice Elena Kagan. You can say breathing is conduct too, but presumably you would not think that it's okay to criminalize breathing in public. And for a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public. At the same time, several justices sought ways to limit the scope of any decision they would ultimately take in the case. Many people have mentioned this is a serious policy problem, said Chief Justice John Roberts, noting the many pressing issues local governments deal with. Why would you think these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments? How does a court make those judgments? Kagan asked, because these are tough judgments. And usually they're the kind of judgments that we think of as municipal officials having to make them. Kelsey Corcoran, a lawyer representing homeless residents, said the Grants Pass blanket law clearly targeted the homeless, while residents who had permanent places to live escaped punishment when lying on blankets in public. The ordinances, by design, make it physically impossible to live in Grants Pass without facing endless fines and jail time, Corcoran said. All the ordinances do is turn the city's homeless problem into someone else's problem by forcing homeless residents into other jurisdictions. In 2023, the California-based 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the homeless residents. The court said that the city could enforce rules against fires, illegal drug use, unsanitary encampments, and other problems, but it could not punish people for sleeping in a public place if they have nowhere else to stay. The court made a similar ruling in 2018 against an anti-camping ordinance in Boise, Idaho. Cities across the political spectrum have said the ruling set an unworkable standard and urged the Supreme Court to clarify what they can do. Theanne Evangelis, the attorney for Grants Pass, asked the justices to end, quote, a failed experiment which has fueled the spread of encampments while harming those it purports to protect. Cities are struggling to apply arbitrary shifting standards in the field, Evangelis said. Without the court's intervention, she said, cities will be forced to surrender their public spaces. The Justice Department argued that the appeals court ruling was too broad and did not take into account individual circumstances, such as whether someone had access to a shelter and refused it. Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Needler said cities need flexibility to implement rules about where, when, and how someone can sleep in a public place, so long as they're reasonable. But Justice Kagan said it's hard to draw that line. Are fires never allowed, even if it's a very cold night? Can tents be erected if it's raining? On the question of open fires, Justice Neil Gorsuch noted, I'm totally sympathetic that that might be a necessity. On any given night in the United States, more than 600,000 people are likely to be homeless, according to the federal government. Last year, 40% of homeless individuals slept under bridges, sidewalks, in parks, cars, abandoned buildings, and other public locations. The challenge to Grants Pass's rules is the most significant case on homelessness in decades. The appeals court relied on a 1962 Supreme Court decision that said someone could be arrested for using illegal drugs, a behavior, but for not being addicted to them, a status. If someone is involuntarily homeless because no shelter beds are available, the Ninth Circuit said, then the camping bans are going after their status, not their conduct, a violation of the Eighth Amendment. But Justice Neil Gorsuch said the difference between status and conduct is a slippery one, and they are often closely related, he said. Roberts likewise hammered away at whether that's a useful distinction. You can remove the homeless status in an instant if you move to a shelter or situations otherwise change, Roberts said. And of course, it can be moved the other way as well if you're kicked out of the shelter or whatever. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wondered whether a better way of determining the fairness of anti-camping rules is not the Eighth Amendment, but allowing anyone charged with a violation to potentially raise a defense of necessity under state law. Kavanaugh said the justices should consider whether state or local laws can address these questions so that federal courts aren't left micromanaging homeless policy. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson likewise wondered if the court could narrowly decide the issue by saying that Grants Pass's rules aren't allowed under a recent state law. Corcoran, the lawyer for the homeless residents, said she wouldn't have a problem with the court avoiding the constitutional issue by deciding the case that way. A decision is expected by the end of June. When it comes to Trump's Supreme Court bid for immunity, his test case is Richard Nixon by Maureen Grappe. A landmark argument Thursday in Donald Trump's long-shot Supreme Court bid for presidential immunity. His test case is Richard Nixon. After Nixon avoided criminal charges from Watergate through a presidential pardon, he set the standard for whether presidents can face lawsuits. An Air Force weapons analyst had sued Nixon, claiming he'd been fired in retaliation for telling Congress about massive cost overruns in the Defense Department. A closely divided Supreme Court said in 1982, Nixon couldn't be held liable for official actions because civil suits would be too distracting for a president and make him unnecessarily cautious when carrying out his responsibilities. Now the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments April 25th on whether that same logic should apply to Trump's attempt to throw out the federal criminal charges he faces for attempting to steal the 2020 election. Many experts think the justices are likely to reject Trump's claim of absolute immunity. But even if they do, how long it takes them to issue an opinion and whether a majority finds that presidents have some immunity will determine if Trump can be tried before the November election. The first and most important pivotal question is whether the court will rule in a way that allows the case to then continue immediately, said Harry Littman, a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. The Supreme Court's decision to hear the appeal of the presumptive GOP nominee has already diminished the chances that a trial that was supposed to start in March can be completed before the election. Well, that's it for today's reading of USA Today. I've been reading from their Tuesday, April 23rd issue. If you have any questions about the articles I've read, call the Chris Listener Line, 860-727-9579. I'm Larry Rifkin. So long until next time.